Okay, good evening everybody and welcome to the summer school lecture. My name is Orla Linsky. I'm an assistant professor in the law department here at the LSE, and it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome you to hear Professor Andrew Murray, who is a colleague of mine in the law department and also has a list of accolades and qualifications that were too long for me to actually write down and recite tonight. So I'll just give you some of the best ofs or the highlights. His most recent was the publication of the third edition of his seminal textbook, which is called IT Law. So one of the first textbooks written, published by Oxford University Press, to deal comprehensively with IT law. You could add that to his other work on his other textbooks and books on digital rights and cyberspace. So Andrew has been one of the first scholars working in the field of cyber law and has created some of the foundational theories for the governance of the internet. So as you can imagine, he's very well placed to talk to us about digital surveillance. I'm looking forward to his talk this evening. Just a few little housekeeping points before we get going. Andrew will speak for somewhere between 55 minutes and an hour, and then we'll hear questions from the floor, so you can be preparing your questions as he speaks. If you are willing or want to tweet to comment on this event, there's no official hashtag, but we've created one, which is hashtag nothing to hide, all lower cases. As you can tell, I'm a very imaginative lawyer. So hashtag nothing to hide, all lower cases. So without further ado, I'm going to pass the floor to Professor Andrew Murray.
Thank you, Orla. A very impressive introduction. I hope we can live up to it. It's called, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. And this reflects this classic argument from people who argue that surveillance is a positive force in society. So what I'm going to do over the next hour is sort of introduce you as to why I think that this argument that surveillance is a positive power in society is perhaps a falsehood. And so why perhaps, even though you might have nothing to fear that you think of, there might be a number of reasons to fear mass digital surveillance. So what I'm going to start by doing is actually to do something people don't usually do in lectures, which is to ask you to start by getting your phones out. Now, this is particularly if you have an iPhone. Similar things work for people who have Android phones, but I have an iPhone and I know how this one works. So if you have an iPhone, I want you to do the following. Go into your settings in your phone, and then you should find, if you scroll down a little bit, something called privacy. It is good. Apple's protecting my privacy. So click on privacy, and at the top, there's a bit that says location services. Now, if it says on, this is good. We're going in the right direction. If yours says off, you're smart enough to turn it off. But let's assume it says on. Click where it says location services, and it takes you to another menu. Menus within menus within menus. Now, you need to go right down to the bottom this time. Scroll past everything till you're at the very bottom, and it says system services. Now, click on that one. Now, you're getting into another menu within menus within menus, and you need to scroll down again, not quite to the very bottom this time, but you should find something called frequent locations, and hopefully that says on as well. So you now click on that one. And now what you find is a little menu of places you've been. You can pick any one of these little menus of places you've been and click on them, and it will come up maybe with a little map now. And it will tell you how many places, times you've been to these places. And if you click on one of them, like I've got one here that says Fleet Street, 8 visits recorded, not surprising, it's around the corner. I click on that, or you click on anything you found, and it will tell you exactly when you were there. There we go. Okay, so now that I've shown you that, you now understand how easily you can be monitored. That is something that is on your phone with your permission. You can turn it off, by the way. But if you turn it off, your iPhone will keep giving you reminders you've turned it off. and say, oh, do you really want this off? I can't tell you where the nearest ATM is. I can't tell you where the nearest cafe is because you've turned this off. Please turn me back on. Until eventually you get so wound down by this that you turn it back on again. And then they know where you've been all the time. That's a particular type of mass digital surveillance. Well, for you it's personal, but collectively for Apple it's mass. There's two main types of mass digital surveillance. The first is called data surveillance, and the second is bulk interception. What you have just seen in action is a very, very, very simple version of data surveillance. Data surveillance essentially is surveying your movements, your activities, who you connect with, what you buy, all these kinds of things, by following your data trail. This might be your credit card purchases. It might be your mobile phone calls. It might be where your phone has been, as that does. It could be your internet use, any kinds of thing. Data surveillance is carried out by both private and public bodies. You've just seen Apple doing it. Other companies that data surveil you include Amazon, Facebook, Experian, a number of others. Also, governments data surveil us. It can be viewed essentially as data profiling an individual and building up an image of what that individual is like just from their data. There's a second type of mass digital surveillance, and it's the one we're going to focus slightly more on tonight, and that's bulk interception of data. This is the gathering of large quantities of data directly from the internet and other sources. This kind of thing tends to be carried out by states because the types of resources you need are beyond those even of Facebook. It's a form of data trawling. You gather as much data as you can so that you have all the information you need at any time that you need it. Now we're going to look at both of these, but a little bit more focus on the second. So, first of all, states and data surveillance. Do states data surveil us as well as companies? Yes, they do. We know they do because Edward Snowden told us that they do. Edward Snowden revealed a considerable amount of information about large-scale data gathering by what are called Five Eyes partners. This is the NSA from the United States, GCHQ from the UK, the Communications Security Establishment Canada from Canada, the Australian Signals Directorate from Australia, and the New Zealand Government Communications Security Bureau. Among the programs that he told us about was PRISM. PRISM is a program operated by the NSA. It gathers large-scale data about individuals from a number of private companies. This is a slide that was originally, as you can see in the top left, the top secret slide used by the NSA to describe the PRISM program. So all these companies in the green box, they are all accessed via PRISM. How does it work? Well, essentially, the NSA makes an application under what's called the FISA Amendment Act. This is the Foreign Intelligence Secure Surveillance Act of 2008. They make an application under Section 702 for a warrant, which they then serve on any one of these companies in that green box and others. The warrant can be for anything, but usually is to carry out surveillance for a period of up to 1 year on any targeted person out with the United States of America. It's illegal for them to serve this warrant on a US citizen. And it can require them to record anything: telephone call metadata, emails, web visits, credit card details, any amount of data, and then to hand it all over to the NSA under the PRISM program. There's a couple of interesting things about this. One, the warrant prevents the company from telling you that the warrant has been served on them. So part of the warrant is to keep the warrant secret. So the companies cannot tell anyone that this has been done. Another thing is, this is really useful for the NSA, is that if you send data in an encrypted format from one device to another device, they can require the company to reveal it, if they have it, in clear or unencrypted format. So it's a way for the NSA not to have to crack encryption. So they just ask Microsoft to hand over the data in its clear rather than encrypted format. PRISM began, we're told, in 2007 in the wake of the passage of the Protect America Act passed by the Bush administration. We found out about its existence in 2013 from Edward Snowden. documents that Snowden has released reveals it is the number one source of raw intelligence for the NSA and accounts for 91% of the NSA's internet traffic acquired under FISA. We only know this because of Snowden, and also because, separately, of a leak that occurred where an order was served on Verizon to turn over all, I repeat, all of its customer telephone data. That's every person who was using a Verizon phone. So the states are involved in large-scale data surveillance. There's no doubt about this. And it's not just the Americans that are doing this. We might just think, well, that's just the Americans. Other people also do data surveillance. The European Union has its own kind of data surveillance program. In 2006, they passed a directive called the Data Retention Directive, which required all telecoms companies and all internet companies to retain metadata and sessional data for a period of up to 2 years. In a European court case, Digital Rights Ireland and Setlinger, that was ruled to be unlawful at European Union law because it was an infringement of our basic rights under the EU Charter, in particular Article 7 and 8. That's the right to privacy and the right to data privacy. Okay, hooray, that's the end of it. No more data surveillance in Europe. It's illegal, we can't do it. We're okay, we don't need to worry as the Americans do. Aha, but that doesn't stop the state. Immediately that it was ruled illegal at European law, a number of states, including our very own, started to pass domestic laws which did exactly the same thing. So we have the wonderfully named Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act, or DRIPA. So DRIPA doesn't sound that frightening, does it? I mean, you're all going to be afraid of something called DRIPA. But essentially, DRIPA creates the same rights to the state that previously had been allowed under the Data Retention Directive. Now, DRIPA itself has been challenged in a case called Secretary of State for the Home Department versus Watson and others. And in fact, only 2 days ago, we got the decision of the Advocate General before the Court of Justice of the European Union on whether or not, in his opinion, it was legal. And his opinion was, maybe, which isn't very helpful, really, if we're being honest. His opinion was, in slightly more detail, that these kinds of powers may be legal at European Union law, but it depends on the safeguards you build in, and that would be a question for national courts to answer. That's the same national court which hasn't done much to protect us recently. This is all really important for us in Britain, because right now, going through the House of Lords, about, 2.5 miles away from us, there is an act called the Investigatory Powers Bill. And it says in that act, the Secretary of State may, by notice, a retention notice, require a telecommunications operator to retain relevant communications data if the Secretary of State considers that requirement is necessary and proportionate. That's clause 83.1 of this bill that is going through Parliament right now, which is going to extend this power to require telecoms companies to retain our private data and, when asked, to hand it over to the government. So this is not just an issue that's going on in the States. Now, you might think, well, this is not unreasonable. Let's think about it. The government is facing a threat. You must admit that today there is this kind of conflict going on between people who want to undermine our way of living and our way of living. So it does not seem an unreasonable thing for us to agree to be monitored if it's going to protect us from serious crime, terrorism, serious harm. And I agree. But I'm going to tell you something interesting. You would think, therefore, that this power to access our communications data, this power that is potentially so invasive, would only be used in the most important of cases, where lives are at risk, where there's a genuine threat. Well, between 2012 and 2014, there were 733,237 requests for communications data. That is 670 requests per day, 28 requests every hour, or roughly one request every 2 minutes. Do you believe that the UK is under such a threat that we need a request every 2 minutes to be kept safe? Interestingly, you might think, well, what about this? This will be refused because, of course, you know, there's a system that protects this being abused. 96% of requests were approved, 4% were refused. What kinds of requests were they? Well, There's a group called Big Brother Watch asked Humberside Police, using a Freedom of Information Act request, to say what they were doing with these requests. It revealed that in the period 2009 to 2012, 3 years, they made 195 applications for traffic offences. They made 47 for criminal damage offences. My favourite, 1,183 for other crime, whatever that is. And perhaps most damningly of all, 197 for non-criminal related matters. So it's not being used to protect us from these really serious threats, would be my argument. It can protect us from serious threats, but there is a danger that it is being abused. Now, the story gets even worse. That bill I mentioned, the Investigatory Powers Bill, it creates a new kind of data that the government wants to request. It creates something called internet connection records. This is in clause 59.4 of the bill. An internet connection record is a record of every website you visit. This is a mock-up produced by the government of what it might look like. So we have a series of dates, all the same date. We have a series of times, the exact time you accessed. This is all accessed from a mobile device, so it has the mobile device number. It has the IP address that you accessed from, where you accessed to, the postcode that that phone was in at the time the access was made using geolocation data, and finally, the actual site that you access, Lloyds Bank, EasyJet, WhatsApp, etc., etc. Now, the government's argument is that this is all perfectly fine. All we're doing is we're not looking at what people do at websites, just which websites they visit. And they say, this is not really any different, perhaps, to recording which phone numbers you call under the old-fashioned system of recording telephone data, telephone metadata. Now, there's a chap called Paul Bernal, who is an academic and activist, and he's written a very interesting piece on this, which sort of illustrates the falsity of that. So this is Paul Bernal's argument. Our online life isn't just about what is traditionally called communications, and it isn't the equivalent of what we used to do with our old landline phones. For most people, it is almost impossible to find an aspect of their life that does not have an online element. We don't just talk to our friends online or just do our professional work online. We do almost everything online. We bank online, we shop online, we research online, we find relationships online, we listen to music and watch TV and movies online, we plan our holidays online, monitoring websites we visit isn't like having an itemized phone bill, an analogy that more than one person used yesterday. It's like following a person around as they visit the shops, both window shopping and the real thing, go to the pub, go to the cinema, turn on the radio, go to the park, visit the travel agent, look at the books in the library, and so forth. And I think he's right. I think he makes a very good point about the way we live our lives online today. And this is not the same as having records of which calls you made to which phones, because that just gives you a name of a person, not what you discussed. But if you were to visit a website, a particular website, you know, www.admittingyourgay.com, that's going to tell the government a lot about your personality, even before they look at what you looked at on that website. So there's quite a lot here going on in terms of the data that is being gathered about us. And the thing I want to take away from this part of the lecture is the government wants more and more and more data on us, because the government believes more data makes us safer. That is their belief. Interestingly, when this was introduced, the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, was introducing this bill. The newspaper, The Independent, made a Freedom of Information Act request asking for all the websites she'd visited between a sort of 15-day period. And the department, the Home Office, refused the request in that it was unduly intrusive on the minister, which is quite interesting. So that's data surveillance. That's part of what states are doing. But probably they're more famous for doing bulk interception. And there's nobody better at bulk interception than GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters. Government Communications Headquarters is based in Cheltenham, but they have a satellite office, quite literally. That's some of the satellites in the background, or satellite pickups. They have a satellite office in Bude in Cornwall. So you might think, why does GCHQ have an office in Bude in Cornwall? Apart from the fact, if you've not been there, it's a lovely part of the country. You should definitely visit. It's good for surfing and all that kind of stuff. But that's not why they're there. They have a program that they operate called Mastering the Internet. And part of Mastering the Internet is the most massive bulk interception program in the history of humankind. This is some of the data that was revealed by Edward Snowden. And it reveals some of the people that they're spying on, this data here. And it's very hard to read from the distance you are, but some of them were interesting ones. They are spying on Thales Freight and Logistics, which is a French company. Why is the British spying on a French company? They're spying on the United Nations Institute for Disarmament. Why are we spying on the UN? And we're spying on EU Commissioner Joaquin Almunia. Why are we spying? Oh, we know why we're spying on EU commissioners, so we can know how to get out of being in the European Union. But we're spying on what are supposed to be our friends. So what is special about Bude? Well, it's the most incredible place on Earth if you're a spy. 10 kilometres south of GCHQ Bude at Widemouth Bay, there is the greatest concentration of submarine cables in the world making landfall. They include Apollo, which connects Europe to the United States, TAT-3, which also connects Europe to the United States, CANTAT-1, which connects Canada to Europe, TAT-8, which connects the UK to the USA and France, TAT-14, which connects Europe to the USA, AC-2, which also connects the USA and Europe, EIG, which connects the UK to Europe and India, and GLOW-1, which connects Europe to West Africa. Also, 5 kilometres south of GCHQ Bude is something called Crooklets Beach, which has the key submarine landing point for all financial data transferring from New York to London. So they can tap into financial data before it arrives at the London markets. That's quite valuable. Now, they have developed a program that they operate from here, which is part of a much bigger program of what's called Worldwide SIGINT, that's Signals Intelligence. And here you can see, this is again from the Snowden files, the main points at which SIGINT is being tapped into the undersea cables. And that one there, that is Bude, just there. So that's Bude, that's a key point. Now what Tempora does is it's essentially a locally stored buffered version of all internet communications that have gone through these undersea cables. And it's essentially a local buffer of the backbone of the internet. In 2013, the Guardian newspaper reported that documents discovered in the Snowden files showed that GCHQ had installed taps on more than 200 fibre optic cables and was able to process data from 46 of them at any one time. Each of these cables carries data at a rate of 10 gigabytes per second. The tapped cables, therefore, had the capacity to deliver 21 petabytes per day. Now, when you start talking about petabytes and terabytes and terabyte bytes and things like that, it doesn't mean anything. You've got to put that in terms we all understand. So what that means is the equivalent of all the information in all the books in the British Library every 24 hours. Not once, not twice, 192 times. So all the information in the British Library 192 times over every 24 hours they can tap into. They have a huge processing capacity. They said that essentially they could store for 3 days, they could store all the data they had tapped for 3 days and all the metadata, which is the descriptive data, for 30 days. And that they can access all that data in that time. And that was in 2013. This is before they've upgraded the system, as they no doubt have done. The authors of their Guardian report noted, for 2 billion users of the World Wide Web, Tempora represents a window into their everyday lives, sucking up every form of communication from the fiber optic cables that ring the world. So they essentially have the capacity to look at everything. And it's not just GCHQ that has this capacity. The NSA has something called X Key Score, which uses 700 servers worldwide, and that's what that map is looking at. That's looking at X Key Score. In January 2014, the German broadcaster Norddeutscher Rundfunk asked Edward Snowden, what could you do if you used X Key Score? His answer, you could read anyone's email in the world, anybody you've got an email address for, any website, you can watch traffic to and from it, any computer that an individual sits at, you can watch it. Any laptop you're tracking, you can follow as it moves from one place throughout the world. It's a one-stop shop for access to the NSA's information.
You can tag individuals. Let's say you work at a major German corporation and I want to access that network. I can track your username on a website, on a forum somewhere, track your real name, track associations to your friends. I can build what's called a fingerprint, which is a network activity unique to you, which means that anywhere you go in the world, anywhere you try to sort or hide your online presence or your activity, I can find you. According to Glenn Greenwald, who broke the Snowden stories, low-level NSA analysts can, via systems like XKeyscore, listen to whatever emails they want, whatever telephone calls, browsing histories, Microsoft Word documents. It's all done with no need to go to court and no need even to get supervisor approval on the part of the analyst. The NSA's data bank of collected communications allows its analysts to listen to the calls or read the emails of everything the NSA has stored or look at the browsing histories or Google search terms you've ever entered. It also alerts them to any further activity that people connected to that email address or IP address do in the future. They have this utterly massive capacity. But, of course, you have nothing to fear. If you have nothing to hide, you've nothing to fear. This is the answer. This is the argument. It doesn't matter if we're hoovering all this data up, because if you're not doing anything wrong, you've nothing to hide. And we're not interested in you. We're only interested in the villains. This is the argument that a number of people make, from left to right on this slide. Well, you know Edward Snowden. I don't need to introduce him. And you can read what he says there. The chap on the left is a Conservative MP called Richard Graham. On November 2015, when the Investigatory Powers Bill was introduced into Parliament, he said, "I welcome this statement, which will help make the country safer. The message today is very clear. We should unite against extremism using all modern tools appropriately. And if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear." In reply, the Home Secretary, now Prime Minister, Theresa May, said, "Well, my honourable friend is absolutely right." Some internet users accused Mr. Graham of quoting Goebbels, because Goebbels is often attributed with this, "if you have nothing to fear, you have nothing to hide" quote. Mr. Graham responded to this, "Clearly absurd to suggest I was quoting Goebbels, who would have used German anyway." Yeah, because that's the argument that we have. It's the language you used. "Amazing how, if you welcome plans to help the security of our country against terrorism, someone in the media manages to bring in the Nazis. Surely you can do better than that." Another person on our slide there in the middle is Professor Anthony Gleese, Professor of Politics at the University of Buckingham and Director of the Centre for Security and Intelligence Studies. In April 2016, in relation to encrypted communications, he said, "I do not think there should be any form of communication that cannot be decrypted or intercepted. The great success of Bletchley Park had in shortening the war relied on intercepting messages transmitted by wireless and cable. Any device that cannot be used for intercept intelligence is a device, in my book, that we do not need." So if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. It should make us all feel better. But this argument, to me, is a false syllogism. This nothing to hide, nothing to fear argument is attributed variously to Goebbels or sometimes George Orwell. It's hard to trace exactly where it came from. I think it's more likely to be Orwell, honestly, than Goebbels. But we see many variations on the need for us to have access to information to provide security. So Donald Rumsfeld, everybody laughed at this, but I instantly knew what he meant when he said this. There are known knowns. There are the things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. These are the things we don't know we don't know. And everybody laughed at the time he said that, but I knew instantly what he meant. There's three types of information. The information you know to have, the information you know you don't have, and the information you don't know you don't have. And as far as the security services are concerned, the third of those is the most dangerous, because you don't know where the weaknesses are in your security setup. And so there is this, what I think, false syllogism that usually goes with the nothing to fear argument, and it runs like this. Privacy restricts knowledge, i.e. it creates ignorance in the forces of security. If we want our security forces to protect us, they need to know everything that they need to know to be able to do their job. Ignorance, therefore, increases risk. If they don't know they don't know, there is a greater risk of harm occurring. If they don't know that somebody is planning a terrorist attack, they can't stop it. Therefore, risk leads to harm. That is a syllogism that is usually used in the nothing to fear argument. But for reasons we will come to, I think this is a false syllogism. I don't think it actually works. And again, our old friend Professor Gleese kind of builds on this. There is wrongdoing happening online. We could collect information about it. Hence, we ought to. I do not believe that civil liberties and liberty generally are undermined by effective, proportionate, and accountable intelligence-led security policy. I think that's a complete nonsense. And Rand Beers, the precondition to freedom is security. So these people, they put security above privacy. And they say that the first condition of freedom is security. And I can see their argument, but I'm going to come later, I think, to why there's a falsehood in it. Some people have kind of been poking fun at the nothing to fear argument. So this is Barack Obama making the usual statement. I think it's important to understand you can't have 100% security and then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience. We're going to have to make some choices as a society. I think that's fair. That's something we should be considering, and it's a sensible approach from Barack Obama. Some people have poked fun at some of the nothing to fear argument. You've got Stephen Colbert. If you're doing nothing wrong, you have nothing to hide from the great surveillance apparatus that the government's been hiding. I like that. If you've got nothing to fear, you've nothing to hide. So why doesn't the government just tell us everything? You know, I like that one. It's quite a good one. And, you know, this is a meme from the internet. If you have nothing to hide, you won't mind me recording all your phone calls. So you can see not everyone subscribes to the nothing to fear argument. And some people can show the falsity of the nothing to fear argument. Meet Stacey Snyder. Stacey Snyder wanted to be a teacher. By the spring of 2006, the 25-year-old single mother had completed her coursework and was looking forward to her future career. Then her dream died. Summoned by university officials, she was told she would not be a teacher, although she had earned all the credits and passed all her exams and had completed her practical training, many with honours. She was denied her certificate, she was told, because her behaviour was unbecoming of a teacher. Her behaviour, an online photo showing her in a costume wearing a pirate's hat and drinking from a plastic cup. Stacey Snyder had put this photo on her MySpace webpage, that's how old this story is, and captioned it, "Drunken Pirate," for her friends to see and perhaps chuckle over. The university administration, alerted by an overzealous teacher at the school where Tracy was interning, argued the online photo was unprofessional since it might expose pupils to a photograph of a teacher drinking alcohol. Stacey considered taking the photo offline, but the damage was done. Her page had been catalogued by search engines and the photo archived by web crawlers. The internet remembered everything that Stacey wanted to have forgotten. Stacey later unsuccessfully sued her university. She alleged that putting the photo online was not unprofessional behaviour for a budding teacher. After all, the photo did not show the content of the plastic cup, and even if it did, a single mother of two was old enough to drink alcohol at a private party. The case, however, is not about the validity or stupidity of the university's decision to deny her her certificate. It's about something more important. It's about the importance of data which represents a version of ourselves online. Another example is Andrew Feldmar. Andrew Feldmar is a Canadian psychotherapist in his early 70s. Well, now he is. In 2006, while he was in his late 60s, on his way to pick up a friend from Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, he tried to cross the US-Canadian border as he had done over 100 times before. This time, however, a border guard queried an internet search engine for Feldmar's name. Out popped an article Feldmar had written for an interdisciplinary journal in 2001, in which he mentioned he had taken LSD in the 1960s. Feldmar was held for 4 hours, fingerprinted, and after signing a statement that he had taken drugs almost four decades earlier, was barred from entry into the United States. Feldmar is an accomplished professional with no criminal record. He knows he violated the law when he took LSD in the 1960s, but he maintains he has not taken drugs since 1974, more than 30 years before he was stopped. For Feldmar, it was a time in his life that was long past, an offence he had thought had long become forgotten as irrelevant in society, as he had become a responsible person. But because of digital technology, the ability to remember all of this, it has been replaced by a perfect memory of his past. So you can argue that much of Stacey Snyder's pain is self-inflicted. She put the photo on her webpage and added an ambiguous caption. Perhaps she didn't realise the whole world could find her webpage and that the photo would remain accessible through internet archives long after she had taken it offline. As part of the internet generation, she maybe should have thought about this. This was different, though, for Andrew Feldmar. Approaching 70 at the time, he was no teenage internet nerd and likely never foresaw his article in a relatively obscure journal would ever become so easily digitally accessible worldwide. But even if Stacey and Andrew had known everything about who everyone could find about their information, is it right that this information is kept forever, or potentially forever? Further, as the Snowden revelations reveal, often information is gathered and retained without our knowledge, or our explicit consent. So, the falsity of the nothing to fear argument seems to have affected Stacey Snyder and Andrew Feldmar. What about the rest of us, though, if we're not putting up pictures of us being drunk? Well, in 1st of July 2016, the civil rights group Big Brother Watch published a report called Safe in Police Hands, an analysis of the security risks surrounding police databases, or, in the words of the report, how police forces suffer 10 data breaches every week and still want more of your data. Some of the data they revealed is here on the slide. Between 2011 and 2015, there were 2,315 data breaches conducted by police staff. Over 800 members of staff accessed personal information without a policing purpose, and information was inappropriately shared with third parties more than 800 times. Some of the things that police officers and civil workers did with our data supposedly held secure: an officer was suspended by Essex Police and is under investigation for abusing his position to form relationships with a number of females. It is suspected he carried out police checks on these individuals without policing purpose. An officer was dismissed without notice for photographing and disseminating restricted documentation for personal gain from South Wales Police. And an officer from Merseyside Police was held to have breached force confidentiality by attending a fellow officer's house and informing him that a sex offender lived in his road. As a result of his actions, the information was then passed on to a third party, not within the police force. So our data is not being held secure. And even if our data is secure, it doesn't mean that it's not being potentially abused. We have a number of examples which show the threats that we suffer, even if we have nothing to fear. You might imagine that one person who has nothing to fear is Lady Doreen Lawrence. She's had much to fear in her life. She lost her son when he was 11 or 12 years old. She spent the next 20 years essentially fighting Metropolitan Police institutional racism. As part of what she has done, she has been elevated to become a member of the House of Lords. You might think she is the example of the type of person Britons want to be. Yet, police chiefs have conceded that undercover officers were deployed to spy on her and her supporters in an attempt to undermine her campaign to have the Metropolitan Police admit that they had been institutionally racist. One officer, Peter Francis, admitted that in 1993 he was instructed to find information that could discredit the Lawrence family. He posed as an anti-racism campaigner in a hunt for disinformation to use against those who criticised the police. This is not right, surely. What about lawyers? Surely lawyers, they must, surely, they're protected by legal privilege. They've nothing to fear. In the case of Davis and Watson in the Court of Appeal, the court had a special discussion on client legal professional privilege, and it cast doubt on any interpretation of the codes of practice which protected a lawyer-client message metadata. The content is protected by legal privilege, but the metadata, the time, the location, the device, all this kind of stuff, they say is not protected by legal privilege. This has been argued is incorrect by the Law Society, by the Bar Council, that this data is also protected by legal privilege because it reveals information about the client and the lawyer. Despite that, Davis and Watson said it is not clear that this is not covered by legal professional privilege. So we can record when you speak to your lawyer, for how long, where from, all these kinds of things. MPs thought they were all covered by privilege. They thought they were all covered by something called the Wilson Doctrine, which meant you weren't allowed to spy on MPs. But it has now turned out that they possibly are not covered. In a case brought before the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, which is the secret court that actually rules on whether or not the government has broken the law in spying on people, but then it can't tell us because it's secret. What it did tell us is that MPs were not protected by the Wilson privilege. This means that authorities were within the law when they intercepted about 5,600 calls from MPs to prisoners, including four cases where calls were downloaded for listening to. That was actually in breach of the rules. But there is no legal protection for communication between MPs and members of the public, prisoners, whistleblowers, or anything else. Journalists, again, they are subject to mass surveillance. There is a paper which was published on 24th of May this year by someone called Paul Lashmer from the University of Sussex. Lashmer has done a number of investigations into all the Five Eyes partners and to see what kind of protection there were for journalists. And he found that essentially about two-thirds or 64% of journalists surveyed believed the US government had probably collected data on their phone calls, emails, or online communications, with 8 in 10 believing that being a journalist increased the likelihood of their data being collected. All journalists interviewed said they were aware of intelligence agencies' ability to monitor their activities. And investigative journalists are saying this makes it more difficult to get people to come forward and tell them things because they're being surveyed. And activists, of course activists are being surveyed, but we can see this quite clearly in things like Belarus. A report from Amnesty International into telecoms communications in Belarus highlights that surveillance has forced activists underground. The report is based in part on interviews from more than 50 activists, LGBT rights, human rights workers, independent journalists and lawyers. It describes how the government's large and secretive surveillance program has stifled dissent and free speech, whether by eavesdropping on email, phone conversations, tracking locations, seizing private information, and then using it to blackmail or prosecute activists. So there is a considerable amount of stifling of free speech going on. Because if of nothing else, at least the fear of surveillance, if not the actuality of surveillance. So this leads me to kind of the last part of this, which is where I sort of take apart this idea that if you have nothing to fear, you have nothing to hide. The increased surveillance will give us more security. The increased surveillance is there to protect us, that the increased surveillance will only drive underground those people who have something to hide, even if these previous cases haven't made you think that already. And it's all to do with something called the insecurity state. So here we have some people I'm going to introduce as we go along. There's a few different quotes here on sort of surveillance in the state. Barack Obama again: the challenges posed by threats like terrorism, proliferation, cyber attacks are not going to go away anytime soon. And for our intelligence community to be effective over the long haul, we must maintain the trust of the American people and people around the world. Dorothy Denning: cyber terrorism could also become more attractive as the real and virtual worlds become more closely coupled, with automobiles, appliances, and other devices attached to the internet. There's this drive that we need to know what people are doing online. As our lives become more online, the greater the threat. We need more information. It's always this drive. This drive for more information. The little quote at the bottom is one of my favourites. Privacy International, who are campaigning against the Investigatory Powers Bill in the UK, they approached a guy called Jonathan Lynn, who used to write for a sitcom called Yes Minister, to write an imaginary letter from one of his characters. And there's this wonderful line in it: mass surveillance is not and could never be government policy, merely government practice. So we don't need it to be policy, we just do it. So what's all this mean? Well, there is this argument, and we see it from all kinds of people who argue we need more information. We need to restrict civil liberties in the interests of greater security, greater personal safety. So on the left is not yet convicted, but almost certainly war criminal, Tony Blair. Civil liberties. What does he know about civil liberties? Civil liberties are a vital part of our country and of our world, but the most basic liberty of all is the right of ordinary citizens to go about their business free of terror. Well, the easiest way to go about business free of terror is get rid of people like him, frankly. That was a good start to making us all safer. So that's the argument. Right to life, freedom from fear, that is first. Anthony Gleese, I keep coming back to Anthony Gleese because I had a fight with him one day, almost physical. Privacy is not an absolute right. Security is an absolute right. And the one on the right, many of you may not recognize, but he's an American judge, Judge Richard Posner. In times of danger, the weight of concerns for public safety increases relative to that of liberty concerns, and civil liberties are narrowed. In safer times, the balance shifts the other way, and civil liberties are broadened. So it's a slightly more balanced thing. He says we change our principles and our values depending on how we view threats, essentially. So we're now in a threat society, perhaps. So I want to introduce you to one of my colleagues, a chap called Dr. Peter Ramsey. Peter's really smart. He really is. And he wrote a really good book called The Insecurity State, which actually was nothing to do with this, but the arguments fit. So what does Peter argue? He argues essentially that the state we mostly recognise, that state that's in that previous slide with Tony Blair and others, is what we call the security state. It's a state designed to make us feel more secure. So the whole idea is that what governments are doing and all these policies, all this mass surveillance, all this intervention is to make us feel better. We're feeling more secure because there's less likely to be a terrorist attack or there's less likely to be serious crime, these kinds of things. So it's all about making us feel safer and more secure in our everyday lives. And he says it's also about making the state feel they're doing things to make us feel more secure in our everyday life. So they feel better as well about it. But he thinks this is wrong. He says that there's actually an insecurity state, that although they're trying to make us feel more secure, it actually leads to a state of insecurity, where both objective truth and subjective autonomy are less secure than they otherwise would be. So what I mean by that is explained by two quotes which come from his book. So talking, first of all, about subjective autonomy, our internal rights to make decisions for ourselves. Anyone who has reason to fear that an act or acts being carried out with the intention of committing a terrorist atrocity is going to be caused to fear that the threatened atrocity may materialise. This may coerce them into making choices that they would otherwise not make, choices that may frustrate their own life plans or even lead them to interfere with the choices of others. So because our media, because our state tells us this is really dangerous, there's a war going on, it's a war on terror, and we're doing everything we can to make you feel safe, we kind of go, damn, that sounds dangerous. I was going to go to Paris, but I'm not going to go to Paris now. I was going to go to that football match, but somebody has said there might be a threat that something will happen at that football match. Maybe even as much as Celtic scoring 3 goals. Something highly unlikely, but you know, just the threat of it happening is the kind of thing that puts us off. So we actually change our behavior because of an imagined threat rather than a real threat. So he says we have less autonomy, we have less free choice because of this perceived threat. That's the subjective autonomy argument. Then there's the objective truth that we're less secure. Any claim of strength made with respect to the right of security lacks substantive foundations. The insecurity state is the institutionalization of the claims to coerce legitimately on grounds the state's weakness. He says all of this really, look at me, I'm big and tough. It's the kind of thing that sort of a weaker animal does. It kind of makes itself look big and strong to try and frighten off something. It's not security that makes you do this. It's insecurity. The government is doing all of this because it's shit scared, frankly. The government is afraid and doesn't know what to do. So it runs about doing whatever it is that GCHQ tells it to do. GCHQ says, we need more data. And the government goes, okay, yeah, more data. Good, excellent. What do you want? When do you want it? How can we get it to you? Because they don't know what to do. They don't have the confidence to say no. Because if they say no to GCHQ or MI6 or anyone else, and then something does go wrong, you can bet your bottom dollar that the spies will leak it to the newspapers that they were blocked by the politicians. And the politicians will then get all hell raining down on their heads. So because of that, they're afraid and they act out of a position of fear, not out of a position of strength. And this affects us, both our subjective action and in the objective. So the subjective action, do we have nothing to fear? Well, we do, because we're creating essentially a world where there's a Bentham-esque panopticon. Bentham created this perfect prison, the panopticon, with its single point in the middle where you can see what all the prisoners are doing. Perfect surveillance from a single point. And it's been pointed out that the way that Bentham described his panopticon, with the prisoner sort of down on their knees here, rounded back, being watched from a watcher that they can't see, but knowing they're being watched, all alone within a crowd of people, that's exactly what internet surveillance and mass digital surveillance does to us in some way. We're on our own in a crowd of people. We know we're being watched. We don't know what's being watched, but we expect it at any time, and we change our behavior. This is the concept behind much of Michel Foucault's writing on discipline and power and discipline and punishment. So Michel Foucault builds on Bentham and says that the modern panopticon is actually a system where we self-monitor ourselves. We don't need the monitor of the panopticon any longer, because there is an apparatus of power which leads us to change our behavior even without that apparatus of power actually watching us. It's kind of like George Orwell's 1984. So Foucault says that the modern panopticon is a modern disciplinary society where we normalize and observe this sort of supplicant activity. So we are now all our own surveyors through a theory of self-surveillance. And this leads to something called the Thomas theorem, which if you've not heard of before, the Thomas theorem is the theory that if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences. In other words, the interpretation of the situation causes the action, whether or not the action is true or not. We are all less ourselves online simply for the fear of surveillance. There is a chilling effect just because surveillance exists, even if it's never being used. The knowledge of it is in itself an effect on how we act. Still, nothing to fear. It also affects objective action, and this is perhaps even the more worrying of the two. You can say, well, the subjective might be true, might not. It's all a kind of intellectual thing. But there is no doubt, and this is clearly true, that the insecurity state is putting us all at risk. If you have nothing to hide, you have a lot to fear. What you have to fear, essentially, is that this surveillance state is based on a model that a certain number of senior people in GCHQ and NSA and others have developed, which is algorithmic surveillance. The more data we have, the more information we have, the more we can cross-check that data with other data, the more likely we are to catch people. It's the replacement of what used to be called HUMINT, or human intelligence, with SIGINT, or signals intelligence. And there is a whole group of people believing it. How many people have seen the latest James Bond film, Spectre? It's what the whole film is about. The character who wants to create this super system, he's these people. James Bond is the old-fashioned HUMINT person. And I prefer James Bond, frankly. So millions, billions of pounds and dollars have been put into computer networks to gather, store, buffer, analyze, interrogate data. And that money has to come from somewhere. And that money is coming from the old-fashioned HUMINT budget. James Bond is being made redundant. Mind you, looking at how Daniel Craig was moving in that last film, he probably should. He was a bit slow on his feet. Now, what is coming out is there is a backlash coming from old-fashioned spies. And their point is simple. You do not catch terrorists by having petabytes of data. You catch terrorists by knowing who to speak to, knowing which questions to ask, and identifying connections through human intelligence. So there's a lot of people are now coming out and saying this. This report here, inside the NSA, officials privately criticize the Collect All Surveillance Society. Terrorist attacks, mass surveillance is the problem, not the solution. NSA struggles to make sense of the flood of surveillance data. They have too much data and not enough time to go through it all. And this is dangerous for all of us. Whether we have nothing to hide, we have something to fear. Often, people talk about finding the right bit of data in amongst all the other data as finding a needle in a haystack. But it's not. It's not that at all. It's finding a particular piece of hay in a haystack. And that is a shed load more difficult than finding a needle in a haystack. Because first of all, you have to know which piece of hay you're looking for. And if you don't know which piece of hay you're looking for, you're never going to find the right piece of hay. So what we have right now is intelligence officers with massive amounts of hay and no ability to know which bit of hay they're looking for. So if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Unless you fear a future employer or customs official finding out that you drink or have smoked weed. You have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear police officers searching the police national computer for Andy Murray in the hope of identifying a tennis star for a friend. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear being surveyed by the authorities as an activist, or that they may intercept privileged communications with my MP or lawyer. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear self-censoring what you say, and so may many others. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear the impact on political discourse, discouraging whistleblowers, and the censorship of journalism. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear the state will record all the websites I visit, and it will use these to label people threatening or extremist, perhaps. Or you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, unless you fear the state's reliance on data gathering to keep us safe. when it's actually likely to make us less safe.
But politicians will keep telling us, if we have nothing to hide, we have nothing to fear. This is ex-Foreign Secretary and now LSE Professor William Hague. Oops, come on, William.
You are a law-abiding citizen of this country, going about your business and your personal life. You have nothing to fear. Nothing to fear about the British state or intelligence agencies listening to the contents of your phone calls or anything like that. Indeed, you'll never be aware of all the things those agencies are doing.
Did you like that bit at the end? You have nothing to fear because you won't even know we're doing it. Don't fear because we'll do it all without your knowledge. So maybe the last thing I'm going to suggest is maybe all of our governments believe that we're all ravenous bug bladder beasts of trowel. What's a ravenous bug bladder beast of trowel? This then shows how many people have read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The ravenous bug bladder beast of trowel is, according to the guide, the stupidest creature in the entire universe, so profoundly unintelligent that if you can't see it, it assumes it can't see you. You're advised, if you ever come across one, to put a towel over your head on the basis that if you can't see it, it'll assume it can't see you and it will leave you alone. So maybe they think if we all don't know we're being spied on, we think they can't know what we're doing or saying. So maybe we are all ravenous bug bladder beasts of trial. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Before we collectively throw our phones in the Thames, if everyone would just like to grab a towel, we'll be on our merry way. So now we're going to take questions for the next 15 to 20 minutes. Does anybody have a question? So we've got the first one down here at the back.
Well, thank you for the talk. My question revolves around this fact. In Edward Snowden's latest interview, he said that despite this massive data collection that we have, it's actually led to no deconstruction of any terrorist attack since its inception. How do the authorities rebut this presumption, and it undermines their entire philosophy? So, yeah, what are they saying to hard evidence like that?
It's an interesting question. The authorities' answer is always the same. We cannot comment on operational matters because it might put people at risk. It's actually, to be fair, to take a kind of balanced approach, it's impossible to tell whether or not this data collection has ever actually interrupted a terrorist attack or not. Now, obviously, Edward Snowden has his position, and some people would call him a traitor, etc., and want him to face criminal trial. The other position, which is put forward, is that perhaps this is true. What we do know from a report that was published yesterday or today is apparently 203 attacks in Europe were interrupted in the last year. But year before last. But it's not clear how they were interrupted. It does seem to be overwhelmingly that when attacks are interrupted, it is old-fashioned human intelligence. It is old-fashioned police work, shall we say, that usually interrupts them. And it's knowing who to speak to, where to go, how to get that information. We cannot know if at any point the authorities have interrupted an attack using this mass data surveillance, because they will not tell us. And I can understand why they will not tell us. They don't want to reveal operational details. But it does seem to me that, I think Edward Snowden is probably right from a position of ignorance, that old-fashioned police work is likely to be more effective. Therefore, that's my argument, that the money is going in the wrong way. And it has another effect as well, in that not only are they building huge databases of information that they can't really use because it's too much data for it to be of any use whatsoever, it's also an unreasonable or unnecessary restriction on our civil liberties for the impact, because legally any impact on our civil liberties has to be proportionate. And it seems to me there is no proportionality with gathering this amount of data for the results it seems to generate. So, I mean, obviously I have a particular view, and no doubt if you had Anthony Gleese here, for instance, he would tell you something very different. But it seems to be that as much of the building of these networks is frankly about empire building by people who control organizations. GCHQ used to be the junior partner in the UK intelligence establishment. MI5 were the biggest, then MI6, then GCHQ. Now GCHQ's budget is nearly twice that of MI5 and MI6 added together. So a very successful campaign by successful directors of GCHQ have created a much stronger empire for them. But well, we can't know, but I agree. I think there is no answer which comes from, but I think it is definitely an unreasonable expense for very little return, and I would rather the money went elsewhere. But anyway.
Thank you. More questions?
There's a great irony here that you've given a lecture on state surveillance or the excesses of it, and as a result of that, there's probably a file on GCHQ on you in the morning. As an accessory to that, there's probably a file on everybody that's attended the lecture on the excesses of state surveillance. In light of that, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but when you're in your earlier part of your presentation, you talked about the metadata and all of the internet recordings that go on through the appropriate use of a warrant. But if GCHQ or NSA got a warrant on you, what protections do they have for the people that have contacted you? So if I email you, what protections do I have? And there's not a warrant against me. Can you answer that?
I can try. I would rather have GCHQ's lawyer answer that. Of course, the answer that GCHQ would give is, although they gather that data on you when you email me, they don't look at that data. So there's an interesting dichotomy here. GCHQ and others treat data as being in two states, essentially, gathered and examined. And they say that the infringement of your right to privacy occurs only when they look at the data. Now, there are other people, in particular, there's a chap called Eric King, who used to be an activist for Privacy International, and he makes very strongly the claim that your right to privacy is infringed when the data is gathered, not when the data is looked at, because he says that's the point at which your privacy is being infringed. GCHQ argued differently. So GCHQ would say that the fact that they have a warrant on me doesn't affect you, because if they gather data on you, you are not the person covered by the warrant, so therefore that data will be discarded when they come to deal with the data. There is an irony in this which GCHQ have never managed to adequately answer, which is how they can tell that the data is about you without looking at it. One presumes the only way that GCHQ can tell whether it's data that is relevant to the warrant or data that is irrelevant to the warrant is by looking at it. I can't imagine any other way that you can tell whether it's covered by the warrant or not, which means that if that is true, it's a kind of falsehood. It's a kind of semi-falsehood, shall we say, because they must look at the data about you to be able to discard the data about you. So in protecting your privacy, they must infringe your privacy. So I think this is the problem, is that there is this, as far as they're concerned, there is this binary state of data, either gathered or examined. But I would argue that there's a kind of Schrodinger's data that is both gathered and or examined and not examined at the same time. And that this data is clearly examined, shall we say, in inverted commas, in breach of the fact there is no relevant warrant for it. So, yeah, that would be my view.
Another question over here.
So given the potential benefits and potential downsides to some level of data collection, in your personal opinion, what do you think an appropriate level of surveillance is for a government to do? And following up afterwards, what kind of security measures would you like to see placed on the data that is connected, whether it has to do with gathering warrants, deleting said data, things like that?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think there is, of course, there is a need for security services to do their job, which means they need data. I think, though, personally, I would much rather that they have the relevant data, which means that, in essence, the way the UK law looks at it, there's two types of data which is gathered. There's what's called targeted surveillance and bulk surveillance. Now, to me, the valuable data is targeted surveillance data. That is data about a person, a place, or an organisation which has been, if you will, pre-selected for surveillance on the basis of some kind of intelligence, which leads you to suspect you will gather valuable data about it. So it might be a particular person or group of people. It might be a particular location, like in the current climate, the GCHQ or MI5 might recognize an extremist mosque where there is extremist preaching being going on. That might be a place for surveillance, the kind of place where you're more likely to uncover the data that you're looking for, rather than kind of saying, let's collect everything and hope we find what we want. It's kind of the difference between kind of going to a fish pond and casting a line with a view you're going to catch that fish there, or going to the fish pond and kind of just throwing rocks at random in the hope that you hit the right fish. So I would much rather they did targeted surveillance, which is a different kind of warrant that is awarded for that, as opposed to the bulk surveillance. How should the data be kept secure? I think it's very important that there should be a restriction on who can gain access to the data. For instance, the communications retained data that you can access under DRIPA can essentially be accessed by anyone down to a local council official. And I don't think this is the kind of people who should be accessing this data. It should be only police officers or security officers who are directly involved in the investigation. And that data should essentially, in compliance with data protection law, should only be kept for as long as there is an active investigation or there is a reason, specific reason, to keep that data. And that should be reviewed regularly by some kind of responsible officer. And then it should be deleted. Because another problem with keeping large amounts of data around is that at some point you will lose control over part of that data. And this is a problem that the police have with the police national computer, that they have too much data and too many people with access to it. Now, I know what I'm saying might sound like it's restricting the ability of the authorities to do their job, but my argument would be it would actually allow them to do their job better, because it would allow them to put the money into what are the key resources, essentially. So that would be my view, is targeted data, active investigations, put the money into the kind of thing that's most likely to produce a result, rather than just millions of pounds in computer data centers, which I think is worth less.
In my view, one of the problems with this mass surveillance is that if we can access all this information the terrorist can too, by just tapping the cables from the GHQ, NSA or something. In Denmark, we just call it PET. Do you think that's a problem? That if the intelligence services can get the data, then the terrorist can too, and they can get access to where we are and control our cars, control the power supply system?
I don't want people to get too paranoid. I think there's two things going on there. One, to be honest, I don't think terrorists want that kind of data about us, but there is a couple of risks that are genuine, what you might call quasi-terrorist risks. One is terrorists and hacker groups are getting better at cyber attacks. One which would be a genuine fear or threat would be an attack on financial markets and financial services. And you could easily see, if they can get into these networks, that it wouldn't take much to cause a kind of cascade effect within financial markets. There are, of course, reports that, which this does sound slightly paranoid, of how you can take over cars and things like that. I don't think, to be honest, and without sort of bringing things to a very sort of somber level, terrorists have demonstrated that the most effective thing is to get in a lorry and drive it. They don't want to use high-tech systems because they're more likely for something to go wrong. So the simple thing is usually the best for groups like terrorists. So I don't fear that kind of reverse effect, if you will. I'm more concerned that governments are wasting money looking in the wrong direction, rather than, while we're building all this massive data retention network, the Metropolitan Police has been cut in size by about 12%, I think, in the last 5 years as part of a system of cost cutting. I'd much rather have these police officers on the beat than I would have massive data centers at GCHQ, to be honest.
Great. So we have another question in here at the back.
So I just want to ask, I think you may have heard this question a number of times, but can't we assume that, say, the prevention of a single terror attack would justify the use of over-intrusive surveillance across the country? Thank you.
That's a really, really good question. Now, the point that is made, and this is one of the points that was made quite forcefully in a recent discussion by Anthony Gleese, was that if you prevent one death, then all of this has been worthwhile. But then you get into the argument over exactly, you know, how much a life is worth, which sounds really mechanical. But, you know, the argument that Gleese and others make is if you prevent one terrorist attack, then you have more than justified this entire expense and this resource and everything like that. My counter argument to him is the thing that is most likely to kill you is in order: heart disease, then cancer, then mostly actually things like road traffic accidents and other accidents. I would rather take all the money, if it's about life, I'm not saying this is what it's about, but if that's the argument, I would much rather take all the money that goes into GCHQ and spend it all on doctors that are going to save your lives. That would actually save considerably more lives than the money that goes into GCHQ to prevent terrorist attacks. Or if you don't want to take it that simply, then you could say, well, then let's take the money and put it into road safety, and spend the money into developing road safety systems, and put the money into more police officers to be road traffic policemen. They will save many, many more lives than the GCHQ system will. I don't believe you should take it down to that kind of level, because I don't actually want to take the money from GCHQ. I think they also do a good job, and it's a jigsaw to fit all the bits together. But I think to try and reduce it to the value of a life forgets what is... There's this common risk error that people make a common error because they read about terrorist attacks and things like that. They assume the chances of being killed in a terrorist attack are high. And the last 20 years in the United Kingdom, with the exception of 2005, the chances of you being killed in a terrorist attack is about 320 million. But the chances of you being killed by crossing the road is about 1 in 20,000. So, you know, if we're going to start doing that, but I don't think we should, but if we are, that's where I think Anthony Gleese and others get it completely wrong. And equally, it has a different effect on our society about how we act, so that's a different matter.
It wouldn't be an LSE lecture if we didn't at one point mention cost-benefit analysis, so we can tick that one off the list. So we've got another question here at the front.
Hello. My question is, what do you think is the role of the private sector in all of this discussion? So recently there was the whole Apple versus the FBI and the Simon and Dean Schroeder's phone. I was just wondering, do you believe that they have an important role to play, or do you think that that's just purely them trying to appear as if they're our defenders in order to increase their, you know, brand recognition, for example?
Tonight I chose deliberately to focus on kind of the role of the state, but you are right, there's an entire separate lecture which has been left to one side about the role of private actors in all this. You know, the amount of data that Facebook has on us is quite remarkable. Now, you've picked up the Apple FBI case, which is a really interesting one. Now, when we started and I said to people, go through your iPhone, of course, that's not data that the authorities have. That's data that is available to Apple and to apps developers. I'm not saying they're actually accessing it, but it's available to them. Now, the Apple versus FBI case is a really interesting one because there's two ways to look at it. You can be very cynical and say it's a kind of marketing exercise by Apple and say, really, what this is about is Apple saying, you have an Apple phone and we'll protect you. We'll protect your civil liberties, you know, not like nasty Samsung or somebody else who might give in to the authorities. So you could see it as a kind of hard-nosed, cynical business measure. I don't think it was, to be honest. I think there was a genuine normative reason Apple wanted to fight that case. And that is the other thing that all these, if you have nothing to fear, you have nothing to hide argument undermines, which is our modern life today is built on the ability to securely encrypt our communications. And we need to securely encrypt our communications when we're talking to our bank, or we're talking to our credit card companies, or we're sending a payment using contactless payment, or a number of other things. So Apple recognized, for the technology industry, the importance of secure encryption. And if you remove that secure encryption by basically engineering backdoors into secure encryption, then that is the case where the terrorists will, and not terrorists, but criminals, will just walk straight through that door. So by undermining secure encryption, the risk of harm through criminality, I think, is massively increased. And Apple, I think, normatively felt that secure encryption was very strong, or was very necessary, sorry, to be able to protect Apple's customers in their everyday business. And to be honest, again, going back to the risk-benefit thing, you're much more likely to suffer some kind of identity fraud or money transfer fraud than you are to suffer a terrorist attack or other serious criminal attack on your person. And so there was a very strong argument there. The interesting thing was the outcome of that case, because, of course, Apple said, we're not going to tell you how to get in through the back door, and we're not going to do this because it will weaken our system. And the FBI said, oh, go on, tell us. And then up popped this company from Israel who said, we can show you. give us enough money and we'll get you in. So what's very clear in this is that there are private companies in Israel who have had back doors into Apple technology for at least 2 years, and they have had the ability to hack Apple technology. Now, these private operators, you can almost certainly guarantee, probably at some point worked for Mossad before they went to the private sector and are using systems and technologies they learned in Israeli security. Equally, on the other side, we also learned about 18 months ago, that apparently through GCHQ, the British government have had the authority to see everything that's going on in Israeli fighter jets for the last 12 years, which was a bit of a shock for the Israeli government. So we're all kind of making everything less secure for each other, I think.
Any more questions? Just one final one from me, I guess, following on from that. So this is a pretty bleak picture that we're painting. If we can't take further steps to prevent, for instance, government access to data, because if a private sector firm refuses to hand over data in the first instance, then the government can root around that by enacting legislation which allows it to hack the private sector database. What can we do here? Are we, for instance, giving enough protection to whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, who are giving us a very small insight into what's going on behind the scenes in an environment that's very much characterized by a neither confirm nor deny mentality?
that's a doozy of a last question.
Just a short one.
Yeah. I think the best thing we can do is throw away all our technology, live in caves, and learn how to light fires. But that not being practicable, it is clear that there is something we all need to do. And what we all need to do, I think, is that there is a prevailing narrative which comes from the state. And the prevailing narrative is the one I've mentioned tonight, which is, greater access to data and greater gathering of data is greater security for us. And you hear that narrative from politicians, and you hear that narrative from newspapers, and you hear that narrative from television news reports and other sources. I think it is very important, if you don't agree with that narrative, to actually speak up against that narrative and to say, I don't agree. And the way to do that is, to encourage more people to get involved and actually have the strength to stand up, like Edward Snowden, who's effectively lost his old life. But I'm not saying everybody has to be Edward Snowden. That's ridiculous. How many of you out there are secret NSA operatives?
Don't
okay,
answer.
Yeah. No, do answer. Go on, do answer. But what you can do is that wherever you're from, whichever country you're from, within bounds, if it's safe, if your country is a kind of country that doesn't like this kind of thing, but whatever you can do that you feel comfortable and safe with is get involved. There's a lot of civil society groups out there who want to protect our right to privacy. There's lots of people who are trying to sort of place that counter narrative. They're almost entirely unfunded or underfunded, and they need volunteers. They need people who are going to go out and do that for them. If you have time and you have the capacity, find out who it is in your state, in your country, is doing work in this area, and go to them and say, hey, I'm interested in this. I have a background in law, economics, policy, politics, whatever it is, and I want to get involved. What can I do? And almost certainly they will fall upon you and say, come, we want you to do something. So I think that's the best thing you can do, is try, if you believe there's a counter-narrative, to support that counter-narrative. So.
Okay, thank you. Before we begin our counter-revolution, I want to first thank once again Andrew Murray for a fantastic lecture this evening. Then finally, invite you all for some nibbles and a drink upstairs to maybe steady nerves and discuss this on the fifth floor of this building, so in the senior dining room. Great, thank you.